President Obama will be taking up different themes on Monday when he gives a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's not so unusual. Most presidents talk to the business group at one time or another. But over the last 2 years, Mr. Obama has had a sometimes rocky relationship with the business community. There are some signs of a thaw in relations, though, and the White House is anxious to continue that warming trend. Mr. Obama knows he's going to need help from business leaders to put more Americans back to work. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Linda.
So why has the president been on the outs with the Chamber of Commerce?
Well, they had some big fights over major pieces of the Obama agenda. The chamber was dead set against the health care overhaul. They had issues with big parts of the financial reform. There was also a perception by some in the business community that somehow Mr. Obama was anti-business in his rhetoric. You might remember when he talked about fat cats on Wall Street. What's more, last year the chamber spent millions of dollars in the midterm elections, most of it aimed at defeating the president's Democratic allies in Congress and replacing them with Republicans.
So is it the shellacking that's led Mr. Obama to take a new tack with the business community?
The White House was obviously somewhat humbled by the election results last fall, and just as the president's tried to reach out and make some compromises with the Republicans in Congress, as he did in December with the compromise deal on tax cuts, he's also trying to partner now with business leaders. He knows that he needs their help in order to speed up job growth in the country. What's more, the chamber was very helpful late last year in pushing for the Korean Free Trade Agreement. That was something of a trust-building icebreaker between the Chamber of Commerce and the president in the wake of the midterm elections. And so now the president and the chamber are looking for other areas where they might be able to work together.
And what would some of those areas be?
First, they still have to get the Korean free trade deal through the Congress, and the chamber is going to be helping with that as well as pushing for other free trade agreements. And in addition, the chamber is interested in some of the pro-business investments the president talked about in his State of the Union speech, like improving the transportation network or better preparing students for the workforce.
All these investments in innovation, education, and infrastructure will make America a better place to do business and create jobs.
Business people are also interested in the president's plan to overhaul the corporate tax code. But we should say that's not necessarily a unanimous position, because what the president's talking about doing, lowering the overall corporate tax rate, but doing away with some of the loopholes, there would be winners and losers in that. Some companies would be very much in favor of that. Some might come out on the losing end.
So what do you think? Will we hear strains of kumbaya coming from the chamber's headquarters on Monday?
Probably not exactly. We shouldn't make too much of this turnaround. The chamber has backed some of the president's initiatives before this. They, for example, supported the stimulus early on in the administration. And there are likely to be big battles ahead, especially when it comes to regulations. The chamber says they're worried about a tsunami of regulations as financial reform and the health care law are implemented. One other thing the chamber says it's pleased about, though, is the personnel moves the White House has made in recent weeks. Bill Daley, the new White House chief of staff, is someone who has business experience. And so the chamber says, even if we don't agree with what the White House is doing, at least there's somebody on the other end of the phone we feel we can talk to who speaks our language.
That's NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Little girls aren't the only ones marketers want. Advertisers are also competing for the attention of grown men. Two giant brands, Star Wars and Volkswagen, have joined forces to bring us what is already one of the most talked about Super Bowl ads of 2011. It's received millions of views on YouTube, and it starts like this.
You would see Darth Vader walking down a hallway, and then you would see that this Darth Vader is in fact a mini Darth Vader who is about 4 feet tall.
That's Michael Caden. He's the creative director of Deutsch LA, the ad agency behind the new Volkswagen Super Bowl commercial. That mini Darth Vader you see in his ad is actually a 6-year-old boy who we see walking through his house.
Trying to use the Force to turn his washing machine on, to get his little sister's doll to move, and basically to bring these inanimate objects to life.
And he does this by he sort of squares his shoulders, strikes a pose, and holds out his hands.
Yes, he is using all the powers of the Force that Darth Vader has to bring these things to life. Then he sits dejected in the kitchen, hand on cheek, very frustrated. He hears his dog bark, which cues him that his father comes home. And he just runs outside the front door. His father wants to give him a hug, but he blows past his dad and goes right up to his father's Volkswagen Passat.
And once again, he lays on the Volkswagen the Force.
Yes, at this point, he's really trying to bring the heat on. Nothing has worked thus far. Nothing has come to life. And then he's using all his powers of the Force, and the car actually roars to life. And he is amazed that he's done this, and then he just jumps back. He's astonished. And we reveal that the father has remote start, and he's actually started the car from inside the house. And the child has no idea, but it's part of these parents' ritual to engage with their son's fantasies.
Now, this ad is already, it's on YouTube. We looked at it on YouTube. Putting an ad like this, which is going to cost you, I assume, millions of dollars to produce and then to buy time on the Super Bowl, why get it out there early?
Well, these days it's all about getting the content ahead of the Super Bowl, so you create a buzz before you get to the game. For instance, we released it just 2 days ago. Yesterday I dropped off my 6-year-old at school, and her friend came up to me and said, "I saw your Volkswagen spot on YouTube." And she started to explain the idea back to me like I didn't know what the idea was. And it was a very funny commercial, and this little boy is trying to bring these things to life. And then none of it works except for the Volkswagen. And unprompted, she played it back as if she was the creative director on it.
Michael Caden is creative director of Deutsch LA. And, of course, you can see his Volkswagen The Force ad online and tomorrow when it airs during the Super Bowl. Michael, thank you very much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Cinderella Ate My Daughter is a new book by Peggy Orenstein, who's written for years about women and girls and how they're treated in this culture. But this book is about Peggy Orenstein, the mother of a little girl named Daisy. She joins us now from California. That is Peggy, not Daisy. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
To explain what's going on with this book, I'd like to ask you to read from the introduction. You're talking about the shock of knowing so much about raising girls and then actually having to raise a girl.
Yeah. I was supposed to be an expert on girls' behavior. I had spouted off about it everywhere, from the Los Angeles Times to the New York Times, from the Today Show to Fox TV. I had been on NPR repeatedly, and that was the problem. What if, after all that, I was not up to the challenge myself? What if I couldn't raise the ideal daughter?
Well, I guess we have to say to you, welcome back to NPR.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, you clearly wanted to be sure that your little girl grew up smart and powerful and independent. When did you discover that your daughter wanted to be a princess?
Well, that's exactly right. When you have that little girl, you think you don't want her to feel like there's anything that she can't be, and you don't want her to feel like there's anything that she has to be. And we were going along like that, and then she went to preschool. And within about a week, she came home having memorized, as if by osmosis, all the names and gown colors of the Disney princesses.
And
yeah. And I thought, what the heck is a Disney princess? And meanwhile, we were going around town and, the waitress at our breakfast joint, who's all tattooed and pierced, would hand her pancakes and say, "Here's your princess pancakes." And the lady at the drugstore would say, "Would you like a balloon? I know what color you'd like." And she'd give her a pink one without asking. And finally, I took her to the pediatric dentist, for her first checkup. She was about 3 years old. And the dentist asked, would you like to get in my princess chair so I can sparkle your teeth? And I just thought, oh, my gosh, do you have a princess drill, too? You know, when did every – I did not remember this from when I was a child. I don't know about you, Linda. But, you know, I did not remember that every little girl was constantly 24 hours a day a princess swathed in pink.
You researched this like the researcher that you are. Can you explain how we got all tangled up with princess? I mean, it was a – You tell a story in your book about a marketing executive from Disney who discovered mm-hmm. Princess Ness.
So Andy Mooney, who had been working at Nike, came to Disney, to the consumer products department, and they were kind of in a wreck right then, and they were not doing very well. And he went out to get to know the brand. So he went to an ice show in Phoenix, and he saw all these little girls dressed as the female characters. And horror of horrors, they had made their own costumes.
Oh
so they
God.
Were not wearing oh. licensed products. This pink light bulb went off in his head, and he realized that he could gather all these characters and license the heck out of them. And the very first year, it was a $300 million business. It brought in $300 million of revenue. And by 2009, it was $4 billion a year.
One of the psychological points that you uncovered in looking through this was that gender is not something that little kids get right away, and that when they're very small, they may actually feel that they could change from girl to boy or boy to girl, and that maybe that's one of the reasons why princessness is so appealing, because it's so girly that maybe little girls feel if they dress up like a princess, it will stick.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you asked about that, because I really think you have to confront the ideas about nature and nurture head on, which I do in the book, and talk about how, on one hand, when kids are at that, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 age, they don't understand the whole anatomy thing. So to them, you're a girl if you wear barrettes and you're a boy if you don't, or you wear pants. And that's why when your daughter turns 3, you suddenly can't wrestle her into pants without her throwing a tantrum, because she needs and wants to assert that she's a girl. So in that way, the princess thing is genius, because it hits them right at a time when they're going to gravitate towards whatever is the most extreme in the culture that will have them represent their sex. So like when I was a little girl, it was more like baby dolls. Now it's putting on your 21-piece Disney cosmetics kit. But yeah, I know. But what's important to also recognize about that is that it's also when little kids' brains are the most flexible and the most malleable. So I talked to a lot of neuroscientists about this and neuropsychologists, and they said that it's also the time when those little differences that are innate to boys and girls, if they're allowed to flourish by having kids grow up in separate cultures, become big gaps.
Now, I wonder if at this end of it, this far along the path, if you think that this girly girl thing is dangerous, or if you think it's just something that little girls pass through, and that they could very well come out the other side as an astrophysicist, maybe with a pink scarf or something.
Absolutely, they could. There's no question about that. But at the same time, there's a kind of flume ride in the culture that is girls are marketed to at an ever earlier age and encouraged at an ever earlier age to define themselves through beauty and play sexiness. You know, there is this constant drumbeat that is telling girls who to be and how to be. And I just think parents, what I hope is to start this conversation that'll help parents be more intentional in their choices, so that their girls can truly have a broad array of choices, not only of, you know, what to be when they grow up, but how to be female and how to be feminine and have that be a positive thing in their lives.
Peggy Orenstein's new book is called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.